persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is the United States versus Gray. Mr. Crawford.
May it please the court, Your Honors. My name is Jack Crawford. I'm an attorney from Indianapolis, Indiana, with the law firm of Crawford and Devane. I represented at trial and on appeal defendant Oscar McGraw. With me at counsel table is attorney Jesse Cook from Terre Haute, Indiana. At both trial and on appeal, she represents defendant Tony McMillan. We have asked leave of court to divide our 30-minute argument as follows. I will present 10 minutes concerning the first six issues developed on the original brief of appellants, and then I will defer for 15 minutes to co-counsel Cook, who will present individual issues concerning Mr. McMillan and group issues concerning sentencing under Blakely and Booker. This is an appeal from a criminal case, Your Honors, from the Southern District of Indiana, Terre Haute Division, heard before the Honorable Larry J. McKinney. Five of the appellants were convicted at trial in May and June of 2003 of violations of 21 U.S.C. Section 841, 18 U.S.C. Section 924, basically a conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute in excess of 500 grams of methamphetamine. Defendant Walter Duraeger was added to this appeal by order of the court. He entered a guilty plea to offenses in the same cause and appeals his sentence before Your Honors. Judge, on behalf of all of the appellants who went to trial, the issue I would like to address with this court is the error that we feel was committed by the district court in allowing Special Agent Douglas Freiberger of the Drug Enforcement Administration to present testimony before the jury concerning his interpretations of intercepted telephone conversations among the defendants and other persons. Defendants contend
that's certainly not an unusual situation, though, is it?
It's not unusual in theory, Your Honor. But
I don't think it's unusual in practice either, is it?
In its application in this case, I think it was very unusual. And I've done a number of these cases, and I've never seen a case agent expert such as Mr. Freiberger given such extensive latitude by the trial court to not only make interpretations of drug codes or drug jargon, and certainly that is permissible under Rule 702 in the case law interpreting that rule, but to go beyond that and basically to give what I would submit was a grand jury-like summary to the jury of all the intercepted phone conversations.
Was there any evidence offered that his interpretation of these words that were used, his code, he said were code words, was a lot of hooey here? And
Your Honor, none of the defendants testified. One of Mr. Freiberger's interpretations was that when Mr. McGraw asked for someone to bring over some lettuce for lunch, he was referring to marijuana, and when he referred to mayonnaise, he was referring to cigarettes. No one testified that indeed was not the case. But the government, Your Honors, was very upfront in how they were going to use Agent Freiberger in this case. In his opening statement, Assistant United States Attorney Mr. Blackington told the jury, "You will hear how DEA Agent Freiberger, who will testify, listen to these communications, listen to these patterns that the phone calls took, and figured out the code, figured out what these people were doing and what they meant." Rule 702 provides, Judge, that an expert witness certainly can give opinion testimony, but he must apply recognized scientific principles and apply those principles in a method that is reliable to the facts of the case. We submit that when Agent Freiberger started talking about his interpretation of what doing something meant, there was an exchange. question, without rendering your opinion at this point in time, do you have an opinion about what doing something means? Yes. What is the basis for your opinion? It is through information which we gather. This is Agent Friedberger testifying. It is through information which we gathered through the investigation about the relationship of Mr. McMillan and Mr. McGraw. It is, quote, something, end quote, I believe it to be either out collecting money or distributing methamphetamine at that time. Certainly, the language, quote, doing something, end quote, cannot be considered drug code jargon or code. And when Agent Friedberger is allowed to say to the jury, I know this case, I've been involved in it from the onset, and through my investigation, I can tell you what people mean when they say certain things. Two dangers in
well,
that.
He's saying his opinion is what they mean.
Just because
he's
his opinion...
offering his opinion is what they mean, and that's his business. He's a drug agent, and hears people say, bring the lettuce, or I want the lettuce delivered here, or something like that. They knows what that means.
Judge, the dangers are, and the reason why I think it deprived the defendants of a fair trial, his opinion is based upon his knowledge of the investigation, which may include a great deal of hearsay testimony from other persons or other cooperating persons who did not testify at the trial. He may have a wealth of information, but the defendants aren't permitted to challenge that because it is siphoned through his mind into giving his rendition of what certain words meant. So,
well, Mr. Crawford, would you be, or are you arguing for a rule which would preclude a case agent from also being the so-called expert language agent for a particular case?
Absolutely.
Because you're not suggesting that.
Absolutely not, Judge, because that's recognized. Case, although, as we said in United States versus Ducagini, as we quoted to the court, when a case agent also testifies as an expert witness in drug codes, the court is required to exercise extreme caution so that the kinds of things that happen in our case don't happen. So the case agent doesn't drift from calling upon his background and expertise, which he may do, to interpret drug codes, and shifts from that to interpreting what people meant based upon his overall knowledge of the investigation.
Well, how would you draw a bright line? I guess any time you have the case agent, as they always seem to be, so heavily involved, in being students of their particular case, how would a district judge filter out that overall knowledge from a phrase that maybe develops just during the course of that investigation, that isn't one that's commonly used in the trade, let's say, but is a code word that's just evolved in this particular case? I'm trying to think of what the cautionary instruction or limitation you would suggest if we're not going to have a hard and fast rule of precluding the case agent from being also the expert language expert.
Judge, I think when the court sees a expert witness going into areas such as saying that lettuce means marijuana, in my 30 years of experience, I've never heard, and of course it possibly could, but I've never heard that as a code word for marijuana. I think the court is called upon to exercise its gatekeeper function. And under Rule 702, the trial judge, district court judge, has a very important responsibility to keep the gates open only so far as the expert witness may testify to matters within his background and expertise, not into his general opinion. What happened in this case is Agent Friedberger usurped the job of the jury and began telling the jury, basically, I think he's guilty. I think all these people are guilty. From my involvement in the investigation, I think they're guilty. He didn't say that in so many words, but that's what it amounted to. And the court needed to exercise a better gatekeeping function and prohibit him from drifting over into those areas where he was telling the jury what people meant. He told the jury that when McGraw said he went to Las Vegas and did more business than gambling, those aren't code words. He told them that from his involvement in the investigation, he interpreted that to mean he was meeting with a co-conspirator named Hargrove to discuss new ways of shipping methamphetamine. McGraw was asked by a friend, what did you go to Las Vegas for? He said, well, they said, did you go there for business or gambling? He said, well, I did more business than gambling. And Freiberger's allowed to say, well, that's not... doesn't really mean more business than gambling. It means he was talking about methamphetamine. when he says, one of the witnesses said they had to go out into the woods to get something. And Freiberg is allowed to interpret that and say, well, that means he was going out to get marijuana from the woods. None of those are code words, Judge. This agent was given a tremendously wide latitude to testify in front of the jury. And I think to bolster the testimony of cooperating witnesses and also to invade the province of the jury. The second issue I would like to discuss with the court briefly is the use of, by the court, permission of the admission of Diablo's Motorcycle Club evidence. Your Honors, during the course of this trial, vests, shirts, and photographs were admitted of the Diablo's Motorcycle Gang information that contained skull and crossbones, the word Diablo, which I understand to be Spanish for devil. All types of demonic symbols were displayed in front of the jury. And I cite the court to this court's decision in United States versus Urban involving the same motorcycle gang, in which this court ruled that the admission of such evidence was reversible error as to one defendant because it was not connected to the drug activity of the persons involved in the Urban case. Likewise, in this case, Judge, there was no connections made between the membership in the Diablo's motorcycle gang and the distribution of drugs. And certainly that gang membership carries pejorative connotations to jurors. I would now like to defer my time to co-counsel Cook.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Ms. Crook. Cook, excuse me.
Thank you, and good morning, Mr. Blackington. With respect to Mr. McMillan's individual argument regarding the suppression of the proceeds of the 2002 search of his home, it's our position that the proceeds of that search should be suppressed because the search warrant, to the extent that it pertained to Mr. McMillan, was based largely upon the proceeds of an earlier search conducted in 2001, which the district court found to be unconstitutional and suppressed. And when the offending portions of the 2002 search warrant affidavit are excised, what remains with respect to Mr. McMillan is less than probable cause to believe that any drugs or drug paraphernalia would be found in his home. Once we've established, as we did, that the portion of the affidavit should be excised because it was unconstitutional, and the burden was on the government to establish that the remaining information contained in the affidavit as it pertained to Mr. McMillan was independent of any taint and was sufficient to establish probable cause. However, what remains in that 2002 affidavit are two facts. One is a reference to two separate telephone conversations to which Mr. McMillan was a party, one dealing specifically with the time of a meeting of the Diablos with no drug references in it, and the second dealing with Mr. McMillan's desire to stop and chat with Oscar McGraw, where, again, there was absolutely no reference to drugs. The second fact relied upon by the government is information which was obtained from an individual identified as confidential informant number one. I'm not going to address the credibility arguments which are set forth in my brief, but do want to focus on the fact that the information from CI1 was obtained before the 2001 search of my client's home. He had no information about any ongoing criminal activity in the home, and it's certainly reasonable to believe that whatever controlled substances or firearms were in my client's home in 2001 were removed by the law enforcement officers who searched the home in 2001 and didn't remain there in 2002. It's important to note that the government's affidavit also contains information from a confidential informant number two who did have information regarding drug activities in the months following the 2001 search of my client's home, and his information contained no reference whatsoever to Mr. McMillan.
Wouldn't that be the same, though?
If
the informant's information is stale, it would seem that that earlier search would be stale, too. I mean, one would think they'd get everything out of there and not leave it all there if that search was illegal. And you're saying that that because he didn't have any new knowledge, that his information is stale, and I assume that would mean that earlier search would be stale too, wouldn't it?
The earlier search was not based upon the information from the same informant.
I know, but it's information that you say was included in the affidavit subsequently.
Well, I believe in the staleness analysis, what we would have to have is some reason to believe that there is criminal activity going on at that venue subsequent to the 2001 search, because we can assume that whatever criminal activity or proceeds therefrom were in the house at the time were removed by the search, so we have to have some probable cause that would show that there was something there more recently. I think that that 2001 search of my client's home is a defining cutoff point. So there has to be some showing of probable cause following that. And that's completely lacking from the warrant authorizing the 2002 search.
If there were deficiencies here, wouldn't the good faith exception save the search?
Well, the court previously found that the 2001 search was unconstitutional because there was a complete lack of good faith with respect to the probable cause that was used to obtain that warrant, and it's the same information that's set forth in the affidavit for the 2002 warrant. So I don't think that that saves the officers here. Furthermore, the officers are aware of the fact by the time they author the second affidavit that the search has already been conducted in 2001 and that these offending items have been removed from my client's house. They should also be aware that what is left in the affidavit from 2002 or from the months following the first search is completely inadequate to evidence probable cause. Mr. McMillan was prejudiced by the search because the proceeds of the search formed the basis not only for the only seizure of drugs from him, but formed the basis for his conviction for the possession of firearms on count 9 and possession of methamphetamine on count 8. With respect to the sentencing issues raised on behalf...
Just before we move on to that, Ms. Cook, was there any inquiry made of the agent, Agent Freiberg, as to his reliance on the earlier warrant during the motion to suppress?
There was no evidentiary hearing with respect to that, Your Honor. I think
was
that...
Was one requested?
No, Your Honor. It was submitted on the briefs and on the affidavits. And I believe that the review of that second affidavit shows that the primary focus with respect to the information that Freiberger had regarding Mr. McMillan had to do with the proceeds of the 2001 search.
But there was no defendant sought an evidentiary hearing on this?
That's correct.
To probe the agent's affidavit or his representations in the affidavit?
That's correct. With respect to the sentencing issue raised on behalf of all of the defendants but for Defendant Gray, whose sentence was based upon a conviction following two prior drug felonies, these defendants were sentenced in the summer and fall of 2003 prior to the Supreme Court's decision in Blakely and raised their issues for the first time in a supplemental brief, which this court granted them leave to file. In each of the cases, the district court imposed what it believed to be mandatory guideline sentences on each defendant. And in each of those cases, the district court made a factual determination as to the drug quantity, which far exceeded the quantity determined by the jury's verdict alone. In addition, with respect to some of these defendants, the district court made factual determinations regarding their possession of firearms during the course of drug trafficking offenses, role in the offense, and obstruction of justice. And with
this won't affect Mr. Gray, though, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. With respect to two of the defendants, Ms. Wolfe and Mr. Duriger, the court also denied consideration of a mitigating role adjustment. In each case, the sentence imposed on the defendants exceeded the statutory maximum warranted by the jury's verdict alone. At the time of sentencing, the individual defendants did not raise an objection specific to the Sixth Amendment issue addressed in Booker, but some of the defendants did interpose individual objections to either the court's determination as to the drug quantity or the manner in which that determination was made. The government, in its brief, concedes that it was error for the court to sentence in this fashion, but argues that a plain error analysis is not met in this case. It's our position that the error committed by the district court judge affected the substantial rights of these defendants. In each case, the sentence that was imposed far exceeded the maximum allowed by the jury's verdict alone.
You might not know this, but I did a little calculation this morning, and this is the 49th case to be argued to a panel of this court since a week ago, Monday, raising issues under Booker. So we've got this in at least that many cases, and I think every case this morning is going to have that issue. And in the cases that are argued tomorrow and I think even next week we'll have Booker issues, so we're quite aware of that, and there's a lot of circulation going on within the court on how we're going to handle and respond to these cases. The plain air issues that are raised here are really no different from
issues
raised in the other cases.
It would be our position that the court should not require an individual showing of prejudice with respect to each of these defendants for a number of reasons, one of which is that the Supreme Court in its decision in Booker did not contemplate that a reasonableness standard would be applied to defendants who were sentenced pre-Booker and obviously not pre-Blakely.
You're saying what we shouldn't do. What should we do?
It would be our position that the court should remand each of these cases to the district court for resentencing.
Vacate the sentence and remand?
Yes, Your Honor.
Just remand.
Vacate the sentence and remand for resentencing so that the district court can grant each of the defendants the type of hearing which the Booker court envisioned. In other words, we would have an opportunity not only to argue that the sentences that should be based upon the factors set forth in Title 18, Section 3553A, which we did not have an opportunity to argue before the district court the first time around, and also that the court, if it found that it wanted to go outside the guideline range, now advisory, would feel free to do so. Specifically during the sentencing of Ms. Wolfe, the district court judge indicated his opinion that the sentencing guidelines were harsh and referenced that in imposing a sentence upon her. It sounded clear from the colloquy which he conducted at that time that he felt absolutely constrained by the mandatory nature of the sentencing guidelines. I think also if the court should impose some sort of a requirement on individual defendants that they show reasonableness in each case, what happens is in those district courts which are the busiest, where the sentencing court, the judge, has less time to engage in any kind of explanation for the sentences provided, those defendants are harmed by having less ability to show individual prejudice in their cases. And
if this were a limited remand just for the court to determine whether or not he would give the same sentence, would that require a hearing in your view as well?
I think that that kind of a limited remand would still require a hearing because under the intention of the Booker court, the defendant should have the right to put into the record for the court's consideration those statutory factors envisioned by Section 3553, some of which we were not permitted to introduce during this sentencing hearing or didn't feel as though we would be permitted to introduce because of the mandatory nature of the guidelines at that time.
Wouldn't have to vacate the sentencing, right?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't have to vacate because some sentences would remain if we followed what Judge Manning was suggesting, right?
That would
be
an alternative, arguably.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yes, I think that the defendants should each be entitled to an evidentiary hearing so that the amount of evidence could be expanded. Thank you.
The sentences here were pretty gigantic.
Yes, they far exceeded.
But do you envision cases where under an advisory scheme the defendants are going to get harsher sentences on remand?
I think that that's a possibility, yes. I think that the district court could, in consideration of guidelines which are advisory only, go above those guidelines in cases where the court might not have felt empowered to do so in the past.
Thank you, Ms. Cook.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Blackington. Mr. Blagden, you're going to have an opportunity to educate Judge Mannion, as you did Judge Evans and I last week.
Well, I was one of the earlier 49, and I don't think there's a free toaster for being number 50. So if I can, I'd like to keep my comments in book or as short as possible. And, of course, the arguments that I've advanced in the brief and we've done have been heard over and over. But there are a few different issues in this case that I just wanted to highlight and move on. Of course, one is that this type of inquiry doesn't matter for William Gray because he was sentenced under the statute. But with respect to some of the defendants, and particularly Fred Lanover, I've certainly heard the concern that some members of this court have exhibited with the plain error standard. But I'd suggest to the court, with some of the defendants here, even if the plain error standard were turned on its head, as it were, and the government had the burden of showing that the judge would have issued the same sentence, we'd be able to meet the burden with some of the defendants in this case. Considering Frederick Lanover, this is the most obvious section. On page 8 of his transcript at sentencing, it's page 16 of the joint supplemental appendix, the court says, "Well, Mr. Lanover, when I look at these guidelines, my first concern is that they take into account the same things I would take into account if the guidelines didn't exist." And they do take these things into account in this case. They take into account the amount of drugs with which you were found to be involved. They take into account the guns found. They take into account the seriousness of the crime of distributing and selling methamphetamine to the public in this area or any area. And so I think that the total offense level here in this range of 324 to 405 months is an appropriate range to consider. So I think that with respect to Mr. Lanover, and there, the judge in the sentencings of Walter Duerigger and Tony McMillan, the judge isn't quite as strong as he is with Mr. Lanover, but if you refer to the joint supplemental appendix in pages 128 through 30 for Duerigger and 179 through 80 through McMillan, I think reading those, you would infer that strongly that the judge would have issued the same sentence. With respect to defendants Wolf and McGraw, the judge is pretty strong about commenting about the egregiousness of their conduct, but it's not the same type of inference that if the guidelines weren't here, you know, I'd sentence you. There's a difference in degree. So I just ask the court, when it applies whatever standard it's going to apply after hearing these 100 cases, that with respect to Lanover, Duerigger, and McMillan, just that it take a close look. There's some things that are here that aren't here in the majority of the cases, and I'm sure this court will decide. From there, I wanted to proceed to address some of the other concerns. With respect to the search warrant at Mr. McMillan's residence, I agree with Ms. Cook that if the government had put no facts into the search warrant after the search in July, that we wouldn't have probable cause to search a residence, and we wouldn't even have a good faith argument, okay? But those facts are there. The original search at Mr. McMillan's residence, if my recollection's correct, was in July of 2001. It may have been June. The statement from individual number one indicated that McMillan was part of an ongoing organization and that he stashed drugs at his residence and dealt drugs through the time the informant gave his statement in November 2001. So we have continuing activity there after July. We also have an intercepted telephone conversation that was referred to in the affidavit that took place 22 days before the issuance of the search warrant and involved in the agent's opinion drug trafficking activity. We also had a situation where one of the informants had indicated that Oscar McGraw, who is the lead defendant, laundered his drug money by buying vehicles and titling them in the name of his business, S&S Engineering. And just a few days before the issuance of the search warrant, the agents went to Mr. McMillan's residence and saw a vehicle titled under S&S Engineering parked in front of his residence. So we do have evidence of continued and renewed drug trafficking activity after the July search warrant, which supports the probable cause finding in this case.
What was the source of the indication that he was laundering with these corporate car purchases?
It was either individual number one or individual number two. It was one of the informants, and I just can't recall which one.
So it had nothing to do with the earlier search, though?
No, Your Honor. The earlier search was developed from a separate murder-type investigation. It wasn't, you know.
So that I understand it, then what you say we have to justify the later search is an informant saying that cars are being purchased with drug money.
Okay. Plus an informant saying that his drug trafficking activity continued through November 2001, 4 months after the issuance of the search warrants, plus a telephone call indicating that McMillan was continuing to engage in drug trafficking activity with Oscar McGraw. Those are, I think, the three things.
When you say continuing, would that mean that there is some foreknowledge that he was certainly doing it before, based on what I guess 2001 search?
That's part of the informant statement, that he was, you know, doing it before and after the search. So I think it's there, and I certainly think under the good faith doctrine the search warrant should be viable. And there's an interesting twist here that it applies, I think, as far as the good faith discussion. In many cases, you know, the agent relied on the 2001 search warrant and the 2002 affidavit, and actually before the 2002 affidavit was rendered, a state court judge said that the 2001 affidavit was valid and that it had probable cause. The district court disagreed. But so I think the agent, to some degree, could, in good faith, rely on the findings and the validity of the 2001 warrant when he composed the 2002 warrant. That certainly should be excised from the probable cause determination, but I think as far as good faith, that's a fact that should be considered.
What if his supervisor thought it was a good warrant as opposed to a state court judge? Think that would justify good faith? Or his reading, the agent read a case from another circuit and thought the facts were similar, and should that be good faith?
I think it's something that should factor into the discussion. I don't think when we're discussing good faith we can ever say in an agent's state of mind whether he objectively believed the warrant was valid or not. I don't think we can ever say that, you know, there's one thing that we should look at and is determinative. I think that could certainly be a factor that you consider, probably less of a factor than if a state court judge thinks it's a valid warrant.
Well, if we'd had a hearing, it might be better.
I think so, but I think the court can also look at it through the Four Corners Doctrine and the validity of the warrant to determine that. Regarding the code language and the scope of the code language, I wanted to discuss about three cases that are cited in my brief, but one of the misconceptions I think the defense counsel has here is that drug code language is kind of like military code language, that there are specific terms that, that all drug traffickers use, like chickens and birds and things, where in fact in the Sabalos case, words like it and them were found to be code language. And in the Vega case, this court went further and said that, you know, even unclear and nonsensical words can be code language in a certain context. So the first thing is, I think the definition of code language should be more expansive than the defense is willing to suggest. And the defense attorney, Mr. Crawford, spent a lot of time about this discussion about lettuce and mayonnaise over lunch hour. There are a couple specific misconceptions there. First of all, this wasn't a lunchtime discussion. It was at 9:50 in the evening, which was kind of odd. And the second thing was there was a lot of stuttering, and this is part of what Agent Freiberger relied on his opinion. Reading from the record, bring me a jar of mayonnaise and a thing of lettuce, okay? That's not bring me some mayonnaise and lettuce to make a sandwich. And he indicated that the stuttering and the speech pattern, the time of day this occurred, and the relationship between Cheshire and McGraw was relevant to his determination that that was code language. So that's not as far off as it would, as defense counsel made it sound.
Yeah, but Mr. Blackington, it seems to me you're arguing for no limits. Because I appreciate that your argument that it may be too constricted of you by the defense. But it seems to me that you're suggesting that an agent could, based on his or her experience in that particular case, I'm speaking now about a case agent, take any phrase, I'm going to buy a Buick this afternoon, and even though that hasn't showed up in our case language, Buicks, that's going to be it. And how does a district judge with, quote, new language?
I think there has to be a basis for opinion, and the proper way to handle this type of case is a defense attorney has to make a timely objection to the specific phrase. Objection to mayonnaise and lettuce, for instance. And then I would have to ask the agent, you know, what's your basis here for believing that mayonnaise and lettuce is code language? And then he could explain, well, time of day at 9:50, the speech pattern, that type of thing. And
so what we have here is a failure to press that by the defense. Is that what you're suggesting?
I think that's true to some degree, but I think we also did establish a basis for the opinions. And the other misconception I think defense counsel has is it's perfect. This court in the Rollins case I cited in my brief has said that it's perfectly acceptable for an agent to rely on information gained during his investigation and even from informants to form an opinion as to the meaning of code language. And that's what you have in a lot of these. I described there were five specific examples a defense counsel raised in his brief. I replied to them in my responsive brief. But I think in all of the occasions here, there was a reasonable basis for the agent's opinion, and there wasn't any type of situation where code language was used or there wasn't a reasonable basis for it. And I do think the other thing that's significant is that defense counsel was given free latitude to cross-examine the agent about the basis of his opinions in this case. Defense counsel asked questions about the mayonnaise and lettuce interpretation. They could have asked a lot more questions about the use of code language in this case, and cross-examination being the ultimate vehicle for arriving at truth by defense counsel having a lot of latitude to cross-examine an agent in code language. I'd sure hate to be the attorney presenting a case where the code language was so far off that they were able to make the agent look unbelievable in his cross-examination. So cross-examination is a way of examining the basis for an opinion. Just to, I also wanted to comment about the gang evidence that was introduced in the case. And the government presented a sanitized version of that. Every witness and myself, Alice referred to it as a club and not a gang.
You weren't wearing a New Jersey Devils sweater, were you, during the trial?
No, I wasn't, Your Honor.
I just wondered. It wasn't apparent from the record about your
No, I wasn't, and it was a very sanitized presentation.
But
and
why was the clothing? Why was the clothing necessary?
The clothing was necessary to corroborate the testimony of various witnesses that these people were members of the Diablos Motorcycle
Club. That was pretty much stipulated, wasn't it?
It wasn't stipulated.
Wasn't? That
no.
You didn't have stipulations You didn't have stipulations from several members there, and I thought
no.
McMillan stipulated his membership?
I think one of them offered to, but, you know, there was
And didn't McGaw's lawyer in opening statement acknowledge membership?
He did, but that's not, I think it's relevant.
He was the president, wasn't he?
He was the president.
Didn't he acknowledge that?
His attorney may have an argument, but again, argument of counsel is an evidence. But I think it was that type of evidence was, and there were a lot of examples in the trial transcript where there were KKK type insignia on the vest that was either removed or not shown to the jury. So the district court took precautions to keep the most odious images out. But this evidence was relevant in this case to show a lot of things, to show really the association between the members of the conspiracy, and that's why the evidence was introduced. For instance, without the evidence of their membership in the motorcycle club, it would be hard to imagine how Samuel Hargrove from California would start fronting 5, 10, 20 pounds of meth to a guy in Indiana. The relationship that they had in the motorcycle club was integral to understanding how the conspiracy formed, and it formed at a motorcycle club meeting in Indiana. It was also germane to show how Don Osborne, who is a witness in the case, came to meet these individuals. The motorcycle club evidence was also germane to decipher various calls, and I mentioned in my brief telephone calls involving Cecil Hutchinson, Daniel Cheshire, and Oscar McGraw, where there's a series of discussions where there's a blend of a discussion about a drug debt and revoking a club patch, and how it made that type of conversation understandable. And this case was very much distinguished in Irvin, from Irvin. Irvin was a possession with intent to distribute case where a joint venture wasn't a necessary element of the offense. This is a conspiracy case. We had to show the association between the parties in the joint venture. Also, in this case, we didn't present a case of guilt by association. The wiretaps were there, the witness testimony was there, like I said, this was presented in a sanitized manner. And I even indicated in my closing, I told the jury, you know, do not find these people guilty because they're members of this club. That's inappropriate. The interesting thing here was that the defense...
You must have thought they might have had that in their mind then, I guess.
The defense was making that argument in closing that this was a war in motorcycle clubs. And that was the interesting thing about this. It was the defense that used the motorcycle club evidence is a sword against the government's case, and they're now claiming to be victimized by the evidence when they were the ones who were using it to say, no, this isn't really a drug conspiracy. Government's after these guys because they're in a motorcycle club. So they use that as a sword. much more so than the government did. The government didn't use it as a sword at all. We showed it, used it to show how these people were related to each other. Just in the balance of my time, I wanted to touch on some of the other issues in the case. First is the wiretap affidavit, and this court has considered the necessity doctrine in many cases. Sabalos and Zambrana are two of them I noticed. And the defense in its brief, the appellants are saying there's a rule of exhaustion that applies. This court's rejected that as a misnomer. And what was presented in this affidavit was very much square with the affidavit in Sabalos. The same techniques were discussed, and all of them, it was explained how the government and the agents had used these other investigative measures, and their use had either failed to demonstrate the whole conspiracy or all of the investigative objectives, or were too dangerous or impracticable to be tried. Going to a few of the other issues, the appellants were objecting to the use of photographs and firearms and the display of photographs. And since this wasn't preserved in the record as an objection at trial, the photographs were maybe 8.5 by 11 inch cardboard photographs that had a Velcro surface and back, and they were mounted to and from a board. They were used specifically where cooperating witnesses testified. I would ask, for instance, Don Osborne, well, do you know Sam Hargrove? And then I'd show him a photograph. So they were used by witnesses to identify people who couldn't be in the courtroom. It was the use of these photographs. So it wasn't like the photographs were up there on display the whole time. They were removed and attached as it was necessary to identify
these. Blackington, is it the position of your office to regularly introduce, in cases, wiretap authorizations when there's no challenge to the legality of the taps?
I don't know about if it's our office policy. I've done most of the wiretap trials in my office, and it's my practice to do that every time. And I do that because I think there are many people in the public, and who, of course, find their ways into juries, who are very concerned with the use of wiretap, and as they should be. It's a very invasive technique. So I think that it's important in cases for the jury to be absolutely clear that the government followed all of the proper procedures to obtain that type of to obtain that authorization, and physically introducing the order and saying, here it is, so that those types of concerns don't apply. I have done cases before where defense counsel has objected to the introduction of the order, and we've agreed to a stipulation that the order existed. There was no objection in this case. Perhaps I should have sought a stipulation. I didn't. I didn't see anything in the order. Now, there's some probable cause determinations and things like that, but yeah, the affidavits weren't introduced.
It gives you some pause. I mean, it's like having an affidavit from the U.S. attorney that a sufficient number of grand jurors were in the grand jury so that this indictment that was read to the Pettit jury can be satisfied. I mean, at what point do you have to have this validation procedure of obviously legitimate law enforcement techniques be paraded before a jury?
Well, I don't think I'd object to the phrase paraded. It was introduced very quickly, and we didn't pass it around the jury and read from it and that type of thing. But I think it's necessary as foundation to demonstrate that the authorization occurred. And I think it's important to make sure the jury understands in this type of case that the government followed the law, did everything right, and here it is in black and white. And I think even If there's anything objectionable, there certainly the harmless error doctrine would apply. Maybe based in this discussion, I should just seek stipulations more, and I think that's certainly a well-taken point, but I don't think there is anything improper about the admission of those orders. Proceeding to file, and also with the photographs, these weren't mug shots. They were photographs of the people. There wasn't anything that suggested a prior arrest or conviction. They were photographs that were taken of these people. With regard to the guns, as I noted in my brief, all of the firearms that were introduced into evidence were found either in close proximity to drugs, cash, or paraphernalia as such. They were tools of the trade and admissible. And also, defense counsels objected to the continuous display of the firearms, but they failed to cite any legal precedent that would establish that firearms should be treated differently than any other type of evidence. There is an evidence table or a series of them. There is a lot of evidence in this case. All of the items were laid out in the table in the same manner. So I don't see any precedent for why firearms should be treated differently than other types of evidence.
Was each firearm identified with a particular defendant?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. They were obtained from search warrants, and the agents who executed the search warrants testified about where they were found, so forth. Lastly is the attempted impeachment of Samuel Hargrove and the perjury conviction. The district court relied on the fact, essentially, that this was outside of the 10-year frame, and in his discretion, he didn't let it in, and I don't think he abused his discretion. And I'd note that the perjury in this case was him attaching a false name in a driver's license application. It wasn't him appearing in court and lying under oath. So I think the district court was well within its discretion to limit the impeachment. And he was impeached, as a matter of fact, with four or five other felony convictions. So that wasn't the only avenue to impeachment that was available. And with that, I don't have any further argument unless the court has any specific questions of me.
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Blackington.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Mr. Crawford.
Judge, first of all, with regard to Mr. Blackington's response to the admission of the court-ordered wire interceptions, those documents were highly prejudicial to these defendants. They contain a judicial finding that the defendants and several other persons have committed, are committing, will continue to commit violations of the offenses involving the receiving, concealment, etc., dealing in narcotic or other dangerous drugs.
Well, why shouldn't the onus be on you to say,
yeah,
we don't... We don't dispute that the government had authorization to tap these phones, and we stipulate to it. Just like a felon possession charge. Isn't it your obligation as a defense lawyer to say, we'll stipulate that he has a felony record so the government doesn't have to?
Quite honestly, I don't recall if that was discussed. It probably should have been a stipulation of those facts to prevent that from coming in. But I know we did object to the admission of these court orders, because they do contain conclusions of a judicial magistrate. Also, Your Honor, with regards to the drug code language, the government, after we cited extensively from United States versus Ducagini at 326 F3rd 45, a Second Circuit opinion from 2002 concerning interpretations of drug code language by a case agent in that case, in which the court found it to be error, albeit harmless error, the government chose not to address that case. It is directly on point. We asked the court to give consideration of that case. It talks about the kinds of language that is allowed and not allowed, and I think it expressly deals with the same kinds of code interpretations that were given in this case that we feel deprive the defendants of their right to a fair trial. I would like to give my co-counsel some time to also rebut.
Thank you, Mr. Crawford. Ms. Cook.
The government suggests that this court should make some sort of an individualized determination with respect to the sentence imposed on each of the defendants in this case, and specifically cites to Mr. Lenover's sentencing hearing, wherein the judge recited the guideline factors that it was considering and indicated that it found those factors reasonable. While that's true, the court was also constrained by the mandatory nature of the guidelines and did not take into account those factors under 3553, which might have made a different sentence also a reasonable sentence for Mr. Lenover. Had the court been permitted or felt permitted to consider Mr. Lenover's age and his medical condition, factors under 3553, the court might well have found that a sentence less than the one imposed would have been a reasonable sentence. With respect to the court's reference during the sentencings of both Mr. McMillan and Mr. Duriger to the reasonableness of the sentence, I think that that is a reasonable sentence within the confines of the hearing that the court felt it was permitted to operate. And I would direct the court's attention to the decision authored by Chief Justice Wilkins in the Hughes case in the Fourth Circuit handed down on January the 24th.
He may become Chief Justice, but he's just the Chief Judge now.
I'm sorry.
In fact, he's a former Chief Judge.
The judge in that case found that there was not necessarily a single reasonable sentence, but that there might be multiple sentences which would be reasonable. And when the case would be remanded to the district court and the district judge felt empowered to consider those other factors, there might very well be additional sentences other than the ones handed down which were reasonable in light of those factors. If I might just briefly mention also, with respect to the affidavit that was used to obtain the warrant to search Mr. McMillan's home, I would ask the court to read the affidavit. I believe that the affidavit does not indicate in it that confidential informant number one ever says that Mr. McMillan's trafficking activity continued through the date of issuance of the search warrant. He was interviewed in November of 2001 and provided a statement at that point in time, but does not specifically say when his knowledge of the trafficking activities was with respect to the individual defendants. Clearly, confidential informant number two, who was interviewed in 2002, indicated that he was acquainted with Mr. McGraw and with other defendants who were engaged in trafficking activities allegedly with Mr. McGraw, and specifically does not mention Mr. McMillan's name. With respect to the vehicle owned by Mr. McGraw, which was found at the site of Mr. McMillan's home, the testimony was that Mr. McMillan operated a business where he repaired vehicles, and there was no relationship between this car and the money that may have been used to purchase it. Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel, and Mr. Crawford and Ms. Cook, an additional special thanks to you and your co-counsel for so ably representing the defendants and accepting this appointment. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the second case of the